You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, unrest in Kazakhstan and a tennis vaccine standoff in Australia. Roundup stories from around the world today at 6 on 1A+. Now today at the U.S. Supreme Court, justices heard oral arguments in two different cases on the federal government's authority to issue and enforce COVID-19 vaccine requirements. Those include vaccine or test mandates for large businesses and another one for healthcare workers at facilities that get money from the government under Medicaid or Medicare. The court's decisions could have a big impact on how the Biden administration moves forward in the ongoing fight against the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone you know affected by either of these cases? What outcome are you looking for? Do you agree with the Biden administration decision to mandate a vaccine requirement or masks as an alternative for larger businesses? And how about for healthcare workers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Brian Dean Abramson is adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law. He's the author of the treatise Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
It is a pleasure to be back.
Let's take a quick look at the two separate executive actions here from the Biden administration at stake here. First of all, this mandate for vaccines with some testing alternative for larger businesses. Remind us, please, what that would do.
That would require all businesses with more than 100 employees to either impose a vaccination mandate on their employees or have those employees tested for COVID-19 on a weekly basis. And that testing would have to be conducted by a third-party testing lab or by some supervisor of the employee. It couldn't be just conducted by them at home because we want to be sure that people aren't faking the results or not bothering to take the tests. So there are certainly some costs imposed by that. And most businesses, the idea is, will decide that they just want to require vaccination of their employees. There are a lot of exemptions built into the regulation for employees who work entirely from home or entirely outdoors. There are religious and medical exemptions available, but generally speaking, for larger companies, any company that has over 100 employees, that has employees who are coming into the office, it would apply to all of those employees.
That's one mandate. And then there's the healthcare worker one. What did that do?
Well, the healthcare mandate or the CMS mandate is interesting in that it comes from kind of a different position. So the OSHA mandate is the government just saying in order to regulate the health and safety of workers, you have to do this. If you don't do this, we're going to charge you a fine, basically as an OSHA violation. The CMS mandate is premised on the government sending Medicare and Medicaid dollars to healthcare facilities. And there are a tremendous number of hospitals, long-term care centers, ambulatory care centers, and so forth that receive as a large portion of their revenue, Medicare and Medicaid dollars. And the government saying, well, you know, this is our money. We get to decide how we're going to spend it. We're not going to send it to entities that do not have a vaccination mandate for their employees. And the CMS mandate doesn't have an out for testing. It doesn't say, well, you can mandate or you can test. It just says everyone has to be vaccinated unless they have a legitimate medical or religious exemption.
Okay, here we are. U.S. Supreme Court expedited, got this thing into a hearing today. These two things, before we look at some of the legal arguments in the separate cases, how much do they overlap? Is it likely that the court is going to use the same principles to decide both the healthcare worker one and the large business one?
Well, I would say that based on the arguments and the tenor of the arguments, the justices are looking at these as two different cases coming from very different positions. So it is quite possible that we could have an outcome where they are determined differently, where the justices do say this is allowed the way that it's been done and this is not. There was a lot of focus with respect to the OSHA argument on whether this is a government agency taking too kind of big of a bite in terms of regulating the workplace. And there were arguments in the CMS argument about, well, whether the fact that the government can just decide how to spend its money the way that it wants and the fact that this is a spending clause argument as opposed to what the OSHA mandate is, which is an interstate commerce clause argument. So they were taken very distinctly. There are also very distinct means by which these were imposed. OSHA has what's called an emergency temporary standard element to the statute that gives it authority to regulate workplace safety, which allows it under very specific conditions that are laid out in that statute to impose a requirement like this on an emergency basis. CMS doesn't have quite the same thing. They do have language which allows them to put forth a rule for an emergency, but it doesn't have quite the same set of constraints. So that's something else that distinguishes them, that the justices are looking at them distinctly for, to see, you know, if one of them is permissible and one of them is not.
We're looking at federal vaccine mandates from the Biden administration, one for businesses of a certain size, another for healthcare workers. In the Supreme Court today with hearings earlier, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see these mandates come into full effect? Do you not want to? Do you think these are things that should be left to the state level, not the federal government, even if you agree in principle with the idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Brian, state mandates have made it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe. What have we seen when it comes to those?
Generally speaking, and then this is going back over a century, state mandates have been upheld. The first case that was brought before the Supreme Court was in 1905, Jacobson v. Massachusetts, and the court said fairly forcefully that states have the right to impose very aggressive vaccination mandates. In that case, it was a law requiring everyone to be vaccinated, not in a particular occupation or under particular circumstances or for access to education or something like that, but every citizen to be vaccinated or face a fine, an actual criminal penalty. And there have only been a few other cases where vaccination has directly come to the Supreme Court, or a vaccination mandate has. But recently, in the past months, the court has denied a lot of requests for stays that have come to it, even though those haven't come as kind of fully formed cases to the court. So that is kind of the position that we're in. And during the oral argument, in fact, Justice Gorsuch mentioned that he had just recently himself denied a stay in a state vaccine mandate case.
What did you hear from justices on the OSHA requirement today? What kind of things were they interested in, asking about, seemed to have on their mind?
The justices generally seem to be split, I think, along three different lines. There were some justices who are very focused on what is called a major question doctrine, the idea that federal agencies can't engage in major changes to basically the way that society as a whole works, and that imposing a vaccination mandate on all employees in these large companies, which is tens of millions of people, is such a change. That was coming primarily from, I think, Justice Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Justice Breyer was very concerned with the fact that the epidemic has become so much more far-reaching just in the couple of months since the OSHA mandate was enacted. He pointed out that yesterday we had 750,000 people who became ill with COVID, and that's 10 times the amount that were becoming ill on a daily basis when the mandate was enacted. And he's, you know, very concerned that how can we say that it's not in the best interest of the public to allow these mandates to go forward. So that's very much a divide that was seen on the court. And I think the primary concern is this federalism aspect. Is this something that should be in the hands of the federal government? And beyond that, should be within the power of an agency to impose a vaccination mandate on a large swath of the population without Congress specifically having said, you have the power to impose a vaccination mandate? And that's also kind of a big question is, you know, does the government have the ability to impose a vaccination mandate where they've spoken to protecting health and safety, but haven't specifically said vaccination? And, you know, that's a novel situation that we're in. So it's a novel question that is facing the court.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Peggy is with us in Boscobel. Peggy, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Peggy?
I just want to express my opinion. I feel that the government is very wrong in trying to mandate this vaccine. People need to be able to make their own choice. And if they do not want it, they should not have to be forced to get it or lose their job. That's not right.
Peggy, thanks for the call. Brian, are these some of the issues that the justices were bringing up today?
You know, one of the interesting things was that all of the justices, it was actually announced by the court that all the justices had been vaccinated and have received their booster shots. That's something that the court acknowledged a few days before this argument. There's no skepticism on the part of the justices that vaccines are effective and the most effective way to end the pandemic, or at least temper the pandemic. The real question is entirely about, is it something that is nonetheless within the power of the government? And indeed, one of the issues that came up was that if people who are fully vaccinated by choice, who have chosen to be fully vaccinated, which is most of the population, if they are better protected from the virus, and the only people that we really need to protect from the virus through a mandate are those who have kind of voluntarily chosen not to be vaccinated, or primarily those people, then is it really the government's business to impose that on them if they've already made the choice not to be vaccinated? Now, it was brought up that there are some number of people who would be vaccinated if they could, but can't because of medical reasons or religious objections. But primarily, this is the concern about whether people who are unvaccinated are really sort of in a grave danger, not just possibly getting sick, but are they, if they're younger people, if they are in a cohort that's less likely to experience severe effects from the disease, are they in this grave danger to which they need to be required to be vaccinated to protect them, even if it's not their choice? And that's something I think the justices are wrestling with. You know, I think the justices who are inclined to allow the mandates to go forward are thinking in terms of, well, we don't want people spreading the disease, even if they're making a choice themselves, that they don't want to be vaccinated against themselves becoming sick with the disease. There's no sense that it's a question of whether the vaccines are effective or whether the vaccines are particularly safe. But there are some exemptions in the statute or in the regulation that allow people with medical and religious objections not to be vaccinated. So it really comes down to people who don't have any kind of objection like that, but still don't want to be vaccinated, and whether they should be in a position where they can be required to lose their job if they're not.
Thanks for that call, Peggy. We're talking to Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law. We're looking at a couple of federal vaccine mandates that came before Supreme Court justices today for oral arguments. You could join in with your thoughts on these federal vaccine mandates, one applying to companies of above a certain number of employees, another to healthcare workers. They both work a little different. Do you like this idea? Do you worry about it? What questions do you have about how they work and what Supreme Court justices had to say about them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law. We're talking about the federal government's authority or lack thereof to impose vaccine, mask, or testing mandates on large businesses and federally funded medical facilities. It's at the heart of two cases Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments on today. You can make your oral argument one way or the other at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Becky is with us in Houstonford. Becky, hi.
Hello there, and thank you for taking my call. I've had a variety of work experiences of being mandated to have either vaccines or protective gear that I wear. In some school districts I've worked in, I was mandated to get the DPT vaccination, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. Pertussis, obviously, is whooping cough, is very, very deadly to the youngest siblings of school children and may even be damaging to themselves. I've been on other jobs where I was required to be tested for and to have vaccination against hepatitis. And on numerous jobs, I've had to wear various protective gear, whether it be hair nets or masks because I was working in a high dust environment, steel-toed boots, various protective gear, including hearing protection. And I certainly believe that people have a right to choose not to get vaccinated or to wear such equipment, but then they're also choosing to not have that job because in refusing safety measures, they put themselves, their coworkers, and the general public at risk.
Becky, thanks for that call. And Becky, I think Brian hitting on some of the arguments from the Biden administration and some of the justices who were leaning that way.
Absolutely. It's a longstanding principle that employers can require employees to engage in a whole range of safety measures. Vaccine mandates coming from employers and coming from states have been a longstanding thing. And one of the things that came up a couple of times during oral arguments was the fact that OSHA has for 30 years had a bloodborne pathogen standard, which, although not requiring vaccination, does speak to the importance of vaccination for hepatitis B for those who are exposed to human blood in the course of their work. Someone raised that in the course of the oral arguments and questioned, well, isn't that just for healthcare workers? And counsel for the government pointed out that actually it can apply to stewardesses and even janitors and so forth if they're in a position where they might come in contact with human blood. And that requirement at least says that they have to be offered the hepatitis B vaccination, and then they have to sign some acknowledgement that they're more at risk if they don't receive it. So it's a bit short of requiring that they actually receive the vaccine, but that's something that was pointed out as showing that the government has the ability at least to address infectious disease, and that promoting vaccination at some level is within their power to do that. So certainly it's very longstanding. It's something that, you know, one of the questions is this within OSHA's reach? And that the bloodborne pathogen standard is something that OSHA has promulgated and has been on the books for a very long time now. And that's something that people should be expected to understand, at least, that there are health regulations, and there certainly are circumstances where people in a particular job will not be able to keep that job if either their employer or some level of government says you have to engage in certain practices and they're not willing to do that. The thing that makes this different is that it is novel for the federal government to be requiring specifically vaccination or testing for employers to impose on their employees. The idea being that if you're not somehow exempt from that, you're going to be terminated from that job.
Becky, thanks for that call. We'll go to Chuck now in Iron County. Chuck, hello.
Hi, I'm a healthcare worker, and we just got a memo today saying that even though I'm vaccinated, I'm going to be put in the unvaccinated group because I don't have a booster shot. So I'm just concerned about continually moving the line as to what a vaccinated is.
Chuck, thanks a lot for bringing that up, because that's Brian. If I have the timeline right, boosters weren't getting as common yet when these were first issued, right?
Right, and part of the Biden administration's plan that they announced on September 9th was to make booster shots readily available, but neither the OSHA nor the CMS regulation has any requirement for booster shots. Mm-hmm. They both consider someone to be fully vaccinated if they've just had the original two-shot series of one of the mRNA vaccines or the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And that hasn't been spoken to in the United States at all. I don't think there is an appetite within the agencies to require that at this point or to attempt to require that, given the stance of their regulations at the moment. There are other countries, Israel, for example, that are requiring people to receive the booster shot to be considered fully vaccinated for access to all the purposes for which fully vaccinated people have access to things.
Chuck, thanks for sharing your story. Time for one more caller. Wayne is with us in Superior. Wayne, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy Friday. I guess I work at a construction site with over 500 people, the majority of which they're all vaccinated and boosted and ready to go. But in a comment to your guest and somebody else would call in and saying that it's absolutely a right to have a job and should have the choice not to get the shot. But my question to them is, how does that trump somebody else's right to earn a living for their family? Because even though they have none or mild symptoms, if they test positive because they were working around somebody that didn't get the shot and got sick, they have to go get a COVID test. It comes back positive, and I have to send them home for 10 days.
Wayne, thanks for the call. So a burden, Wayne says, for that vaccinated person if they get infected by the unvaccinated person. Is that a burden in our last minute, Brian, that the court is interested in?
Yes, the court is very interested in that. And that's one of the things that they also talked about, this concern that on the one hand, if you require vaccination, people will leave their jobs or be forced out of their jobs. But on the other hand, if you don't require vaccination, then you'll have people getting sick or becoming contagious, and then they won't be able to perform in that job anyway. So that's something that justices are considering as an equity that might balance out.
Wayne, thanks for that call. And Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
We've been talking to Brian Dean Abramson. He's an adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law, wrote a treatise on issues related to vaccination laws. We talked to him today about two COVID-19 vaccine mandates. They came from the Biden administration. They were argued today in challenges before the U.S. Supreme Court earlier in the day. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, small businesses around the country face a lot of uncertainty after a series of COVID-19 surges, especially places like restaurants and bars and entertainment venues. Find out how they're getting along and what kind of federal programs are doing to try to help. And used car prices are way up, and it could be a weird year for anyone shopping for a new ride. We'll find out what's driving the market, and you could share your stories. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up, a new reporting project is shedding light on the financial conflicts of interest involving members of Congress. We'll look at what's being revealed and how Wisconsin's congressional delegation is doing after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn how to cook with beans, grains, seeds, and legumes for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, should members of Congress be allowed to trade individual stocks while they're in office? Right now, they can. Some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle want to make that illegal. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of them. She posted on Instagram last month, quote, "Because we have access to sensitive information and upcoming policy, I do not believe members of Congress should hold trade individual stock, and I choose not to hold any so I can remain impartial about policymaking." House Speaker Nancy Pelosi disagrees. Here's what she said when asked about it before the holidays.
Because this is a free market and people, we are a free market economy, they should be able to participate in that.
There is a law called the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge, or STOCK Act. It says members of Congress are forbidden from using non-public info to make trades, and it requires regular reporting of stock transactions. Pelosi said lawmakers do need to follow that. According to our guest, most of them are, but some blur the lines a little, and a few have some explaining to do. For the last 5 months, he and his colleagues have been investigating the personal finances of every sitting federal lawmaker and their top staffers. They've found many conflicts of interest related to COVID-19 info, U.S. defense policy, environmental issues, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should members of Congress be allowed to buy and sell individual stocks while in office? Why or why not? What questions do you have about this STOCK Act? What's acceptable and what's not? What do you want to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave Leventhal is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. His reporting on the finances of members of Congress is part of Insider's project called Conflicted Congress. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
You and your colleagues covered a lot of ground over the last 5 months or so. What were some of the basic questions you set out to answer here?
So going back to 2020, there had been a couple of incidents, a couple of episodes where lawmakers ran crosswise into the law that you just described, the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act, of 2012. And what was happening was in the early days of the pandemic, there were questions about whether they were using information that they came upon by virtue of them being members of Congress and acting on that information in a way that helped them basically game the market, make trades, stock purchases, stock sales, that would be beneficial to them personally. So flash forward about a year, we had begun to see sort of a critical mass of situations where lawmakers were just either not following this law or making trades that seemed to be, if not in violation of it straight up, in violation of the spirit of the law. And we found also too that a number just weren't complying with the law. And also, you know, in having to disclose the activity that they were by law, by their own passage of this law that they had to do, that they weren't living up to that. So that led to us wanting to really ask the question, hey, is there more going on here? And in prompting us to dig deeper.
I want to look at both halves of the Stock Act. So one part is, as you said, members of Congress, according to this law, aren't supposed to use inside information they might get from, say, a committee hearing or something like that to influence their stock sales or purchases. How is that enforced? It seems like it might instantly have a lot of gray area there.
Well, first of all, it is very difficult to prove. There's an incredibly high standard, a very high bar for investigators being able to say Senator so-and-so or Representative so-and-so actually did engage in insider trading in a way that is illegal by federal law. And in fact, nobody has been criminally convicted of doing so under the Stock Act since that was passed about a decade ago. The only exception would be Chris Collins, a former House member from upstate New York, who he engaged in related activity, but ultimately wasn't charged under the Stock Act, although he was convicted in stock-related shenanigans, if you will, that landed him in federal prison, although he was pardoned in December of 2020 by then-President Donald Trump. So that's the one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, too, is, you know, even if you are able to get beyond just the insider trading aspect of all of this, there's the disclosure aspect of all of this. And the Stock Act, as you mentioned earlier, does not prohibit members of Congress from trading individual stocks. That was something that was initially proposed. It was rejected by Congress as part of the final bill. And in the thought then was that, hey, if lawmakers are going to, in a very timely fashion, disclose the nature of their personal stock trades, then that's going to be good enough to defend against conflicts of interest. That's all fine and good, but the Stock Act's disclosure provisions are only as good as the compliance with those provisions. And we found in our reporting 52 lawmakers over the course of 2021 who did not comply with the Stock Act's disclosure provisions. Sometimes in a fairly minor way, it might be a stock trade or two. They would have been late. They have between 30 and 45 days to disclose their activity, and perhaps they were a week or two late. Others were months or even years late, and the total amount dollar-wise of their assets that they were trading, the stocks that they were buying and selling, sometimes numbered into the millions, and even in a couple of cases, tens of millions of dollars. And none of this was being disclosed in the time frame that was set forth by the Stock Act, which is Congress's own rules of the road for itself.
If I'm a member of Congress, and I'm not, but if I buy and sell some stocks, I don't disclose these things, these sales, say, by the deadline, big amounts of money in those, what happens to me?
Not much. Almost at worst for you as a member of Congress would get a $200 fine. And that would be the case whether you were a couple days late or months late. It would also be the case if you had just traded a few hundred dollars of stocks or a few million dollars worth of stocks. So the carrot in the stick are really almost non-existent here. There's very little that is incentivizing people to follow the law. And if you don't follow the law, there's very little that is in the way of punishing you for that transgression.
talking to Dave Leventhal with Business Insider, part of a big investigation into Congress and financial conflicts of interest, often related to stock sales and purchases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be illegal for members of Congress to buy and sell individual stocks? What kind of accountability, what kind of transparency do you want to see when it comes to members of Congress and their financial investments and assets? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, you didn't just look at the Stock Act, you and your colleagues in this report. You also looked at potential conflicts of interest where, say, I'm on a key committee working on an issue and I own stocks in a business directly related to that issue. What kind of things did you find there?
Well, first of all, we found more than a dozen lawmakers who are tasked with shaping U.S. defense policy because they sit on either the House or the Senate Armed Services Committee. They are people who also were actively investing in military contractors, companies such as Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman, those who make bullets and bombs and weapons systems. So, many people that we talked to said this is a gross conflict of interest and they should not be doing that, although it is perfectly legal for them to do so. We found a number of very environmentally minded Democrats who are rated very highly by organizations such as, say, the League of Conservation Voters, who in their speeches and their public statements are very environmentally minded, but they were also investing, we found, in fossil fuel companies or power companies that have fossil fuels as a significant amount in their portfolio of energy generation power plants. The list goes on and on. I think one that affects everyone in a major way is that we found almost 75 lawmakers who had stock holdings right as the pandemic was taking place in the year 2020, who invested in Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, the three big vaccine, COVID vaccine producers here in the United States, or had investments in companies that we were able to identify as being very pandemic sensitive, companies that make tests for COVID, or PPE, personal protective equipment, that was, of course, being used and still is being used in the midst of the pandemic. So that, too, raised a major issue in the minds of many of the folks that we talked to for this article as to whether that type of activity should be legal and whether lawmakers should be doing that or not be doing that while they're members of Congress.
And we've seen some lawmakers claim, hey, there's COVID news is in the newspaper. As an investor, I could have gotten this information publicly. Are there indications at all that they may have gotten some advance warning before the public got it that might have influenced their buying or selling of stock?
So what we know is, in general, members of Congress receive much more secretive or information that would be out of the public eye than you or me or any general American. It's impossible to know what they're saying in those meetings or what they're hearing or what they're reading when they get secretive information or classified information. So unless you're in that room, it's almost impossible to tell. And therein lies really the rub here. You have people such as Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, who say, look, we can, as lawmakers, read the news as well as anyone else. We're not doing anything that is illegal. This is a free market economy, and lawmakers should be able to participate in it as well as anyone. The other side to that is, well, lawmakers are elected to represent the people. They are not elected to represent their own personal financial interests. So whether it is a perceived conflict or an actual conflict, lawmakers should hold themselves to a higher standard, so this theory goes, and they should effectively abstain from engaging in this, or Congress, the argument goes, should ban lawmakers, ban itself from making these types of trade so that there is no issue in the first place.
We're looking at potential financial conflicts of interest involving members of Congress and their staff. Dave Leventhal is our guest, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. There have been efforts to make it illegal for lawmakers to buy and sell individual stocks while they're in office. They fell short. They still can do those things. Do you think that's a good idea? Would you like to see things change? What would you like to see done to avoid financial conflicts in Congress? What questions do you have about existing laws like the Stock Act and other measures to prevent conflicts of interest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some new reporting on financial conflicts of interest for members of Congress. Business Insider spent months digging through financial disclosure reports for each sitting federal lawmaker and some of their top staffers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's appropriate for members of Congress to buy and sell individual stocks? Do you worry about it raising ethical questions, conflict of interest questions? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dave Leventhal stays with us, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. He's been working on Insider's Conflicted Congress Project. Let's go to your calls now. Louie is with us in Oconto. Louie, hi.
Yeah, I believe they should have to put their individual stocks in a blind trust and have it managed by an outside interest. Doctors have to do that. They used to have drug companies come in and wine and dine them, and that's kind of went out the wayside because there was a conflict there. I believe there's a conflict. There probably was a conflict in stopping Line 3. If you had an interest in that oil company, you really wouldn't want to stop it, even though you know it might be the best for the country.
Louis, thanks a lot for the call, Louis, referring to a pipeline there. But the blind trust idea, Dave, what kind of options are there out there for a member of Congress?
Lawmakers right now can put their assets into what's called a qualified blind trust. And a qualified blind trust is something that Congress itself has said is sort of the highest defense against having a perceived or an actual conflict. It would be money that is not only put into an account that is governed by an independent trustee. So therefore, the lawmaker has not only an arm's length relationship, but really no relationship with his or her own money, cannot control it. But also, too, the trust documents are published publicly. Anyone can read them. And it's approved, the trust, by either the House or the Senate Ethics Committee, depending on which House the member is in. So although that is an option, the answer to the question of, well, how many people have in Congress have availed themselves to creating a qualified blind trust? We ran the numbers, we checked every member of Congress and only found about a dozen who have gone ahead and created such a trust. It is expensive to do so and it takes some time, but most members of Congress just simply don't choose to go that route at this point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Wendy joins us now in Neenah. Wendy, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I worked for many years before retiring back in Wisconsin as an ethics counsel for a federal agency in Washington, D.C. And obviously what I was working with were the ethics laws that apply to executive branch employees, which are a little bit tighter than what currently applies to Congress, although the Stock Act also applies to members of the executive branch. It seems to me that we want to hold our elected representatives just as responsible, if not more, since they're creating the laws, as we hold members of the executive branch who are employees of the government. I've seen a lot of problems over the years, especially under the criminal conflict of interest statute in the executive branch. But there are certainly are situations in the legislative branch that mirror what I saw in the executive branch and were not handled in anywhere near the same fashion.
Wendy, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. I appreciate it. Dave, are there efforts to raise the standards for members of Congress? I guess that would have to be a law, though, passed by Congress.
It would be. And Wendy's absolutely correct that the executive branch rules and regulations, rules of the road are different than in the legislative branch in Congress. And in many cases, they are more stringent on the executive side than they are on the legislative side. Congress is its own cop on the beat. Congress is its own referee. And Congress alone is in the position to strengthen these rules if it chooses to do so. There are a couple of different bills that at this very moment are pending in Congress. They're mired in committee. They have not been debated in any full-throated type of fashion on the House or the Senate floor and seem to be going nowhere fast, at least at this point. But there are at least a handful of members of Congress who are making this an issue, not the least of which is Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, who's been very outspoken in her belief that that the rules should change. But this is not a Democratic and or Republican type of an issue. I mean, this is a truly bipartisan phenomenon that we found, both in terms of the members of Congress who do choose to trade individual stocks. Democrats and Republicans do it almost straight down the middle. And also those who have violated the Stock Act's disclosure provisions. Democrats and Republicans have done it almost straight down the middle as well. So in a way, there's a lack of incentive for a bipartisan solution in that you have both Democrats and Republicans who, perhaps understandably, perhaps not, are concerned that if they do something that is going to restrict their activity or if they do something that could really hurt the other side, that it's going to come back to bite them in the end. So in a way, the choice here is for Congress to do nothing as to do something that is going to be strong and decisive when it comes to individual stock trades among members.
Talking to Dave Leventhal from Business Insider about potential conflicts of interest facing members of Congress. Dave, you went lawmaker by lawmaker and state by state with a number of criteria. What did you find in the Wisconsin delegation?
So we ranked every member as part of conflicted Congress on a set of standard metrics across the board with every member. And Wisconsin's delegation did pretty darn well, actually, by our ranking. We gave everyone a grade of either green, yellow, or red, solid, borderline, or danger. And only one member of Wisconsin's delegation fell into either the yellow or the red levels. Senator Ron Johnson got a borderline grade, a yellow grade, for a Stock Act violation that we discovered one of his staffers had made. Also, too, part of our methodology factored in whether the lawmaker had a qualified blind trust and whether the lawmaker traded individual stocks. Senator Ron Johnson does not have a qualified blind trust. Again, that's very common among members of Congress, and he does choose to trade individual stocks. So our rubric gave him a borderline grade. As a result, all the other members in the Wisconsin delegation, both Republicans and Democrats, got a green solid grade.
Time for one more caller. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi there. I believe that Congress people should not be penalized from participating in our economic system, such as buying and purchasing stocks. I mainly feel that we, as with many other things, we already have enough laws. They just need to be enforced better. And so I do not believe we need any more laws regarding this. We just need better enforcement.
Rose, thanks a lot for the call. And Dave, with the existing law, like the Stock Act in particular, is there any talk of more enforcement, whether by congressional ethics committees or by the Justice Department?
And that argument was made by many of the lawmakers that we talked to, that, hey, we don't need more laws. We don't need to go and create a system where lawmakers are limited in what they can do when it comes to the buying and selling of stocks. And they felt that way even despite the fact that many of the companies that they invest in spend significant amounts of money lobbying Congress and buy for significant government contracts too. But put that aside here for a second. The enforcement mechanisms, at least in our reporting that we found, are very weak. And if it is going to be the case going forward that lawmakers will be able to continue to trade and buy and sell in individual stocks, the related but separate issue of whether the internal enforcement gets better because it's demonstrably and objectively flawed in what we found, that would need to change too. And there's very little talk, at least at this juncture, of Congress doing anything that would strengthen that aspect of the Stock Act.
Rose, thanks for that call. And Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dave Leventhal is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. We talked about the financial conflicts of interest facing some members of Congress. We've got a link to Insider's Conflicted Congress Project, by the way. You can find it at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A chef tells us how to make grains, beans, and other hearty staple foods in our kitchen more fun and delicious. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.